The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
Cloudy skies. Welcome to this Wednesday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up in just a moment, from K through 12 to institutions of higher learning, how the current pandemic could reform education. We'll discuss disparities rural school districts are facing, and also how Spelman College and Oglethorpe University handled the sudden shift to all online classes and what the campus experience could look like in the fall.
I thought I had seen everything, but this crisis is like nothing I have ever seen before. And I think it's challenging everybody in ways that none of us have ever experienced.
That conversation coming up in just a moment. But first, as always, the latest information regarding COVID-19 here in Georgia. As of noontime today, there are 25,274 confirmed cases. The number of deaths statewide is reported to be 1,052. And there are 4,948 hospitalized. Again, that's all according to the Georgia Department of Public Health as of noontime today. Stay tuned. There's more Closer Look just ahead. Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. This is Atlanta's Choice for NPR. As always, I'm Rose Scott. Today's program will focus on education, K through 12, and higher education. We'll begin with colleges and universities. How has the coronavirus pandemic affected this current academic year? And what about long-term effects? Right now, many institutions of higher learning, they're already grappling with the issue of closing budget gaps. And now comes a pandemic. Well, joining me now to discuss all of this is Dr. Mary Schmidt-Campbell, president of Spelman College, and Dr. Larry Schrall, president of Oglethorpe University, for a few months longer. Thank you both for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Well, good morning.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Rose.
Yeah, good to be with you.
Let's talk about right now, and if you all could just open up with your reflections on what I've been saying for about a month now, which is that this is an extraordinary time in our nation, in our world.
You know, Rose, I've been thinking about this. Before I came to Spelman College, I had a career in New York City for about 40 years, and I've seen a few crises. When I came to the city was on the verge of bankruptcy. I was at New York University, which is in Lower Manhattan, when September 11th happened. We lived through a fiscal crisis in New York, the 2008 collapse of the markets. I thought I had seen everything, but this crisis is like nothing I have ever seen before. And I think it's challenging everybody in ways that none of us have ever experienced.
And President Shaw.
Yeah, and I would agree. I think, you know, it's different, I think, in a couple ways. So one is, it's really unclear about when there will be an end, and maybe if there will be an end. I think in other crises we've had, there seemed to be a clearer path to moving on. And I think the other thing I would note is that it's happening at a time when our politics are so unhealthy that the response to this crisis seems less comprehensive and less thoughtful than it has been to others.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to something that President Campbell just said, and she talked about this was a crisis that she had never experienced. I want to shift for a moment before we get into the other conversation and talk about leadership. Was there any takeaway from you all in terms of being leaders doing something like this? And Dr. Campbell, I'll let you go first.
I think what Larry said is very true. This is the kind of crisis where you don't know where the end is. So I was thinking of this crisis of, let's build a bridge over these troubled waters. You know, we'll get through this, because you're assuming that at the other end, there's going to be all this will go away and we'll get back to some form of normalcy. Mm-hmm. I think as we are living through this crisis, I'm beginning to see that this is a moment where we have to begin thinking about reshaping the kinds of educational institutions we have so that they can be more resilient and responsive to a crisis like this that may occur again. Mm-hmm. I mean, we may get through coronavirus, but what if yet a new virus emerges somewhere down the road? So that's one thing. The other thing, as from the point of view of leadership, is that you realize that, honestly, that's what our institutions have been doing, all of us. You know, none of us looks now the same way we looked at the beginning. I mean, Spelman started in the basement of a church, mm-hmm. right, as a seminary. So we're not the institution now that we were then. So we've always been in this place where we've had to reinvent ourselves. And so once you enter into that mindset, then I think you can begin to look at this as an opportunity to do some creative thinking about who you are as a college.
President Shaw, leadership during a crisis for you?
Yeah, so I think the people that sit in our positions that had to make some really difficult decisions very quickly, but that's not particularly atypical. What's been interesting for me to watch, both Spelman and Oglethorpe, we have a model of education that mm-hmm. depends on faculty, sitting face to face across the classroom, the seminar room with students. And that's, what we both do extraordinarily well. And when it became clear, literally in the, space of a week to 10 days, that model was not gonna work, at least for the short term, it was really interesting to see our faculty sort of move to a leadership role. Mm-hmm. And particularly, I'd say, our younger faculty. I mean, we don't do online education, so we literally had to convert every course, hundreds and hundreds of courses in the space of a week or 10 days to online. And people my age and who didn't grow up with this technology find, I'm just managing to figure out how to join a Zoom meeting. But our younger faculty really sort of took the lead in not only taking and putting their courses online, but creating opportunities to teach other people how to do it, and they're still doing that. So it was an interesting moment where our younger faculty stepped up into a leadership role.
It's a really important point that Larry's made, that all of a sudden we've found ourselves in a learning mode, mm-hmm. For all the reasons that he just said. And finding that that's actually a pretty exciting place to be.
But Dr. Campbell, the process of shifting to an all online learning mode, how would you assess you all having to shift to do that? Was it smooth?
I would say at the outset, when we first came to the realization that we're going to have to make this shift, I will just speak for myself personally, for all the reasons that Larry said, given my error, it looked absolutely daunting. Mm-hmm. But in fact, it immediately became clear that our faculty really rose to the occasion, and there was an extraordinary sharing, that same kind of sharing of resources. And I've heard that said on about other campuses, that there was a sharing of those who were adept and skillful at the technology were very willing to help out their peers, their faculty peers. Mm-hmm. We also stood up a week's worth of intensive training sessions. And I have to say, even those who were most skeptical about making the transition very often ended up at the end of that time period being real champions. So as I said, it was really revealing to see the way faculty did take leadership, but also the way they embraced the excitement of being able to put some new tools in their sort of pedagogical toolbox.
Mm-hmm. How has all of this potentially going to impact you on from a financial basis? And President Campbell, I'll stay with you. You and I, we've had conversations about the plight of historically Black colleges and universities and small liberal arts colleges, and now comes this pandemic. Have you all looked at projections in terms of financial loss to the institution?
So you know, Spelman starts from a very strong position, you know, balanced budgets, you know, we were building an operating reserve, you know, strong endowment performance, not wealthy, but healthy. Mm-hmm. So we've spent, we've charged our finance division to look at four possible scenarios for the academic continuity of the college. And they are doing that analysis as we speak, because with whatever option we choose, we're thinking this is a bridge over troubled waters. We have to get to the other side, and that means we have to come up with a financially sustainable model to take us there. We haven't completed our analysis yet, but that's going to be a huge challenge. I mean, if we don't have a residential campus, we don't have income from our residence halls. Mm. And that's a very large number each semester. There's market volatility. So our endowment will no doubt be hit. And then there's all, you know, are students going to want to come if the college is not residential? So there are lots of variables. That could impact us financially.
President Shaw, what about you all? Let's talk about finances. Have you all taken a loss so far?
Right. So, you know, I think when you look sort of globally, schools that entered this crisis in a sort of healthy place, and Oglethorpe's fortunate to be in that place, well, in the short run, I think we'll be just fine. I do think there's going to be a... there's going to be a fallout that's going to accelerate, I think, the risk to sort of financially unstable institutions, and there are a bunch of them. So we've looked at this. There's a, you know, there's the sort of immediate hit that you took by sending all students home 8 weeks before the semester ended, and refunding, rebating their room and board. You know, for us, that was about $1.2 million that we gave back, and if we've already done that. Then you've got the summer revenue, which, you know, we send 500 or 600 students abroad in the summer. So there's probably over $1 million of revenue loss in the summer. Some of the federal aid that's now beginning to filter down will help. But as I say, we entered this financially strong. The challenge is what happens in the fall, as Mary said. And we're looking at some really interesting ideas for the fall. So we typically start school in mid-August. Mm-hmm. I think it's likely that we will push that start back to after Labor Day, just to give us some breathing room to get past this immediate crisis. Mm-hmm. It's pretty clear to us that the virus will be around in the fall, and that given the lack of testing, we're going to have students and, you know, come back to campus when they can come back. And some of them are gonna, some of them will have the virus, but very, you know, asymptomatically. Mm-hmm. And so we're at the process of sort of asking faculty to think about, even when students come back to campus and we're again teaching face-to-face, how do we social distance in a class? So it may be that if you have a class on Tuesday and Thursday, you have half the students in that classroom on Tuesday, the other half online, and then you switch that out Thursday. So everybody is getting a face-to-face experience, but not crowded into a classroom. So it's it will change things, I think, until there's universal testing and until there's a vaccine. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to be operating differently. And I heard on NPR the other day, which was interesting to me, that the the quickest we've ever put a vaccine into the market was 4 years. Mm-hmm. So if you just assume we somehow are able to cut that in half, you know, we're not going to have a vaccine in the fall. We're not likely to have one in the spring. So we're going to be operating in a different mode, I think, for some time.
This is a good time now to take a break. Thank you, Dr. Shaw. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. This is Closer Look. Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. This is Atlanta's Choice for NPR. As always, I'm Rose Scott. If you're just joining us, I'm joined by Dr. Mary Schmidt-Campbell, president of Spelman College, and Dr. Larry Shaw, president of Oglethorpe University. And we're talking about how this coronavirus pandemic is not only affecting this current academic year, but in terms of long-term for higher education. I want to go back to something that President Campbell talked about, which was, she said, if we don't have a residential life, you know, on the campus, and we all know that part of the college experience is that campus experience, that student body experience. President Campbell, how concerning is it for you that maybe that will change? And students may say, well, you know what, if Spelman's mostly online learning, that takes away that experience that I've always wanted.
The on-campus experience and residential life is designed specifically to be part of the learning experience. Mm-hmm. Whether it's an HBCU or whether it's a majority-serving institution or whatever, the whole nature of residential life is structured to make all parts of it part of the academic, intellectual, and social life of the college. When I had a conversation with small groups of students, and with one of them, they said, you know, when I was at college, I was learning how to be independent. I had started to grow. I was away from my home, making decisions for myself, and now all of a sudden I'm snatched back at home. And so they're very conscious of the fact that the process of going away from home is part of their coming of age, mm-hmm. right? So I couldn't agree more that it's really vital. At the same time, I think we have to let the facts and science guide us, and let good public health practice guide us in our decision making. Because we also don't want to bring students back to a situation where we're essentially a residence hall is the equivalent of a cruise ship, right? Mm-hmm. If you've got 300 students housed in a residence hall, you've got a density and it's almost impossible to exercise the kind of physical distancing that's required. So I think we have to be very measured, and we're hoping that I think, as Larry has said, you know, that we may be able to make some kind of mix, some hybrid model, some way for us to maybe start late, and you know, but right now we're looking at least four different models, mm-hmm. of how we might start the campus. But realistically, for the health of everyone, we have to consider what would it be if we could not come back to campus at all. If all of a sudden the virus comes back and it's raging and it's just impossible for us to do that.
President Shaw, you will not be the president, and when school returned, as a president through your lens, could the student body experience forever be changed because of this pandemic?
So we have every expectation that we will be open in the fall, whether that's, you know, early September or late September, not entirely clear yet. If you look at our, you know, you read in the news that students are thinking about not taking a year off, or schools should expect a 20% drop in enrollment. If you look at our registered numbers for returning students, if you look at our numbers for our first year students, entering students, they're both setting records. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty clear to me that students want to come back. It's also, I think, pretty clear to me that things will will be open come fall. You know, the governor's open, trying to open up some things now, but I think by fall things will be open. So I think the challenge is going to be, how do you keep your faculty, staff, and students as safe as you can, by looking at, again, different models. You know, we have one dining hall, so we're likely to, you know, open up multiple places where students can eat, so they're not, you know, sitting close to each other and doing some interesting things with classes. So we'll be open in the fall. I have no doubt about that. And it'll look a little different, but I think it will still largely be a residential experience, although maybe a bit of a different one.
I'm curious, has either of the institutions, are y'all been applying for any type of funding? Is there any funding out there and either the stimulus package that either Spelman or Oglethorpe will be able to receive some funds?
So I'm glad you asked about that. we've all received the amounts that were going to be allocated through the CARE Act, and half of that has to go to student emergency funds. And then we've got some guidance on how the other half can be used. But there are several other buckets of funds that are still outstanding. And one is through the state. And so the governor, Governor Kemp, like all governors around the country, has received an allocation for higher education. So we're waiting to see how he plans to allocate those funds. For HBCUs, we understand that there's also an additional allocation for HBCUs. Mm-hmm. And so we're also waiting to hear about that. And then I believe there's a package of loans that's available as well. So we're still sorting through what the stimulus will, what resources the stimulus will give us as we move forward.
President Shaw?
Yeah, it's the same. I mean, this the legislation got rolled out very quickly, and the regulations guide the distribution of money seem to be changing on a daily basis. And yesterday there was a whole new set of directions that came out. One of the ones that I found most disturbing. So there's this pot of funds to be distributed, emergency funds to be distributed directly to students. Mm-hmm. We got that money yesterday, but with the guidelines that it could only go to certain of your students. And they specifically, we have a very significant population of Dreamers on campus. Mm-hmm. And they specifically excluded Dreamers from getting any of those funds, which I found astonishing. So
what can you do for those students?
Well, best we know at this point, there's no federal money, and I haven't seen any state money that's available to those students. So if we're going to do that, we would have to do it out of our own funds, which is something that we're looking at. But I think it was, you know, I appreciated the intent behind getting some of this legislation passed so quickly, but it, what I think suffered in the meantime was wasn't entirely thought through, and you see this with the SBA loans, where the recipients of some of those loans are not particularly who people thought were going to get them. So hopefully that'll all get sorted out. But and again, we've not heard anything from the state. So I would say we'll be fine. Our students will be fine. The fall is the big question, and I saw today the CDC, you know, suggesting there's going to be another significant wave in the middle of the winter. And so I think we need to be prepared to be disrupted again.
President, to your knowledge, any of your faculty or staff or anyone on the, has anyone tested positive for the virus? Have you lost anyone?
I don't know. And I'm putting this in this way very deliberately. I don't know of anyone who has either tested positive or has come down with the illness. I do know of some of our students who have relatives who are ill, and I just learned of a student who lost her mother yesterday. So, and I think all of us in our communities, in our various communities, all, and frankly, all over the country, know of someone by now who's either been been touched by this or felled by it. So I think it feels, we all feel that it's encroaching to some extent or another.
Mm-hmm. And I would say the same. We've had a staff member who lost her mother. My five-year-old grandson was in the hospital for a week with pneumonia. But we have not, we did, when we sent all our students home, we did have a student who was flying home and actually passed on the airplane, not virus related, but we held a virtual Zoom memorial service for her, which was beautiful. Mm-hmm.
Currently, there are no students at all on either of your campuses?
We have four. Mm-hmm. We had three, but I think we had a set of parents that sent one back to us. So we've got four at the moment.
We actually have about 40. Several of those are international students, and the remaining students are students who just for one reason or another did not have an option to go home in the middle of the semester. We are now making arrangements for everyone to be off campus during the summer. We are not going to house any students at all on the campus during the summer.
President Campbell, you said about 40. How are you all able to help those students with some of their basic needs? And is there a way that the community can help?
So thank you. I really do appreciate that you're recognizing that. In fact, our faculty has stepped up very early on and conducted a really great, very robust campaign so that faculty and staff have, over the past few weeks, been making gift baskets, which we have forwarded to them. Alumni have participated. We have, as many campuses do, we've had an emergency fund to which we had a huge response. We had 830 donors in it in a matter of days. And so we've been able to provide students with emergency funds. Our dining hall is open. We have a dining hall in that dorm, in that residence hall, which is open, that specifically serves those students. Mm-hmm. They have access to telehealth, to counseling, and of course all of our technology infrastructure so they can continue their coursework. Our public safety is on campus. We, our mail center is still open, so we're not, our campus is not closed, mm-hmm. by any stretch of the imagination, so the students there are still receiving not only their instruction, but they are being supported by services either online or actually in person.
And finally, as we wrap up, I know it's tough when you're a senior and you can't wait to put on that cap and gown and walk across the stage. And President Campbell, I've been to so many Spelman graduations. I know that energy. I know that was tough when both of y'all had to realize, it's like with so many other institutions, there won't be a traditional graduation this year for those seniors. What can y'all do for them?
So we did we just surveyed our seniors and their parents, gave them a number of options, including a sort of virtual May 9th commencement. But it was very, they all want to walk across the stage. this was my last one here. And so it's disappointing for me as well. But so we're planning a commencement, or sort of a live walk across the stage commencement in the fall, timed with parent weekend. And one way or another, we're gonna mail their diplomas out, so they will have them this summer, but that they will all have a chance to walk across the stage in their gowns.
President Campbell.
That's exactly the same with us. We haven't set a date, but we are definitely gonna do an in-person commencement. Overwhelmingly, that was the sentiment of the graduating class. We'll probably organize some form of a virtual salute to the seniors. That's just saying, you reached this milestone. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. See you at commencement.
Dr. Mary Schmidt Campbell, president of Spelman College. I was also joined by Dr. Larry Shaw, for now president of Oglethorpe University. Congratulations, President Shaw. You are turning a new chapter in your career.
Yeah, not the way I thought I'd go out, but that's okay.
Listen, thank you both for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Best of luck to you.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. Be well.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. This is Atlanta's Choice for NPR. As always, I'm Rose Scott. Let's talk about K-12 online learning during this time. Now, with this coronavirus pandemic further widen an education gap that currently exists, and also, what are those socioeconomic barriers that currently present challenges to online learning, not only for students, but educators? And now apply this to rural communities. From a lack of connectivity to a lack of funding, we've had this discussion many times on this program.
You have students who are in the education system who have challenges, and it oftentimes costs more to educate those students. And at the same time, rural communities have a smaller tax base, which means they're not getting the same funding they would need to educate students who are oftentimes a little bit more needy in terms of what they need to perform.
So those students who go home without access to internet and cannot do some of their classwork and some of the research that's necessary, there's a disparity there. There's a disparity between those children who have access to the internet at home and those who do not.
Now, that was Dina Perry, Executive Director of Broadband at the Georgia Department of Community Affairs. We also heard from Robert Gaines, Director of Communications for the Georgia Partnership for Excellence in Education. Now, under the CARES Act, President Trump's $2 trillion stimulus package, it actually allocates $25 million for distance learning for students in rural districts. But is this enough? Is it really just about money? And what effect will all of this have on students and education in the long term? Well, joining me now to discuss all of this about what to do, what we can do to help rural school districts, we have Dr. Broen Reagan-Martin, Superintendent of the Early County Board of Education in Southwest Georgia, and Dana Rickman, Vice President of the Georgia Partnership for Excellence in Education. Thank you both for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having us on.
Let's begin with you. Before the pandemic, we had always talked about these barriers and these challenges to the rural community, to school districts in particular. And now the conversation is about that's going to further widen an achievement gap for those students.
Well, I will say definitely we're seeing disparity in our student population. We have, we're in a very rural area. We have areas in our county that are even more rural than others. And a lot of our students do not have internet access. So even though they may have devices, they don't have access to the internet in some of the areas in our county. And so they're not able to participate in the online learning that is going on.
So even prior to this pandemic, with now everyone's having to shift to online learning, in your part of Georgia, this was already a challenge just because of connectivity issues.
Absolutely.
And, you know, Rose, connectivity, as you mentioned, and, you know, having broadband access, that's not the end of the story. Mm-hmm. That's one of those things that it's necessary, but it's certainly not sufficient, or the other way around. But I mean, that's your first building block where you have to have internet connection. But beyond that, we're talking about the availability of high quality instructional materials, the resources within the home to fully utilize them. And so if you're looking at it from a statewide level, as you mentioned, we're already working from sort of a inequality deficit, mm-hmm. where you had systems that were sort of already up and running, especially in the more metro areas, the ones that were already more connected, a little more fluent, where online learning, virtual classes, online assignments were more typical. And so they were able to make that switch mm-hmm. a little easier. I mean, this is all relative, of course, but a little easier to sort of, you know, distance learning from the home, where we had other districts that were not in that area at all. And so the startup cost of that is huge. And so just the ability, it's not just flipping a switch to suddenly everything is online. Mm-hmm. And so the ramp up costs, the getting all the materials together, assuming students and families even have the connection to do the work, which is not true. And so there's levels of problems here.
Right. No, I was going to agree with Dana and say we are not a one-to-one district, meaning not all of our students have devices. We do have what we call our Google Project teachers. And so we have teachers in our system who have Chromebooks, but they're classroom set. So they have carts of Chromebooks. So those teachers are prepared with the distance learning, but we do not issue devices to every student. Then we have other teachers who are not a part of the project, some either who are not interested in the distance learning at this time or the Chromebooks and the Google Classroom project for whatever reason. So those teachers are struggling more with the online learning. We're having paper packets go home. So yeah, there are many layers, as Dana said.
Well, Superintendent Reagan Martin, that was my next question. I was going to ask, how are you all currently able to do this in Early County?
Right, it's a combination. So the ones who have had the Google Classroom project, for those students who do have internet access and who do have devices, they are doing just amazing things. They're very innovative and creative, and they're doing Zooms with their students and having all sorts of online projects going on. But for our other teachers or other students who either were not Google Classroom teachers or the students who do not have the connectivity that they need, they are trying to figure out how to do these paper packets by themselves. And if they don't have parents who are helping them at home, it's been a challenge for sure.
I want to ask you one more follow-up question. For our listeners who may not be familiar with Early County, sort of paint the picture. Give us the demographics of this part of Georgia. This is in Southwest Georgia?
Yes, we are in Southwest Georgia. We're right next to Alabama. So we're right on the border of Alabama, not too far from Florida. So right above Seminole County that borders Florida, about 60 to 70 miles south of Columbus. So down in the corner. And our student population is 70% African American and just rural, not much industry, a lot of agriculture. So we are surrounded with our peanut fields and our dirt roads and our pine trees down here.
You're not far from Doherty County, are you, in the Albany area that's had that is one of the big mm-hmm. epicenters?
That's exactly right. And if you look at the map, you'll see that we are that high concentration area, along with Doherty County, Randolph County, Early County. We're down there in that corner that is struggling with high numbers of the virus.
And that, of course, compounds a whole nother set of issues for that community. The voices you hear, we have Dr. Broen Reagan Martin, superintendent of the Early County Board of Education. That's in Southwest Georgia, she just said. And Dana Rickman, vice president at the Georgia Partnership for Excellence in Education. I feel like this is a good time to shift to solutions, but we still have to, I think, for our listeners, bring home the severity of this. And Dr. Rickman, when you hear what the superintendent just said about those challenges, this is not lost on you and what you all do at your agency.
It is very sobering. And I don't want to be too negative or too down for our listening audience, but this is a real crisis. This is something we know, the Georgia Partnership is really rooted in research and best practices, and the stuff that we've looked at, like we know the students that lost just a semester of schooling after Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. It took them more than 2 years to catch up from that lost learning time. And that was just a single semester, and many of those students were actually able to go to schools in other areas. They left and went to Houston or Baton Rouge or wherever. And so we're looking at really an unprecedented situation of loss of learning time. I think, though, there is some opportunities here that could present us with some really good opportunities to really think more innovatively and really almost redesign how we deliver education. You know, nothing like a crisis to really focus an issue. And we've had these equity issues in Georgia and across the nation for a really long time. And a lot of students have not been served well, despite really heroic efforts by our teachers and our educators. And so it's giving us an opportunity to really think about how do we deliver instruction differently? How do we think about reaching those hardest to reach students? Mm-hmm. What are some alternative learning plans? And then most importantly, what are the resources that will be needed to support this at a statewide level? And so you get the same kind of quality of access that you would in Metro Atlanta, also down in, you know, Grady County and Early County and across the entire state. And so we're really looking at this as an opportunity to make some significant positive changes in how we deliver education for our students. But it's going to be a hard shift.
Well, and speaking of a hard shift, because that sounds great moving forward in the future, but when we talk about this current generation, those kids right now, the current K through 12 learners right now, and Superintendent, when you think about when the school year starts in the fall, and hopefully we'll be back to some sense of a normal, traditional school setting for the kids, how concerning is it for you that they will be, a percentage, maybe behind already?
Absolutely. It's a huge concern for us. When I've talked to superintendents around the state, you know, that's one of our biggest concerns in areas like ours, that instructional gap that is going to exist for those students who have had very little instruction if they haven't had internet access. And yeah, they may be able to get a paper packet, but it's nothing like having a teacher in the classroom. So we're trying to figure out, you know, already, of course, we're looking towards next year. What is that going to look like? Trying to figure out if we're going to have a core period at the beginning of the year that's just going to be a catch-up time for some of our students to try to get them caught up with this loss of learning.
Is that the best approach, you think, if you're able to determine that with some of these students who have lost a lot in terms of learning, is this the best approach then when they come back in the fall, that it will be just about catching up? Not for all of them, obviously, but for some?
Sure, not for all of them. Well, you know, there's a possibility of maybe an earlier session if we could do something in the summer, but we just, right now, we don't know that we can plan for that. So we're waiting to see how circumstances change, and if things are safe, we might be able to bring kids back for like a summer mester, mini mester before school starts.
Dr. Rickman, let me ask you this. Is this simply just about having more money for these rural school districts? Once you mentioned all these innovative ways that you all will look at, but then as we all know, when it comes to implementing anything new as it relates to education, funding is always an issue. I mean, we could spend another segment talking about No Child Left Behind, but a big issue is that there was no funding for the program after it was passed.
Yeah, I do think it's going to take some significant resources, but I don't think the answer is simply more money. I think it has to be, how do we really highlight what is needed and how do we resource what is needed? And so, you know, in the more immediate need, thinking about like this summer, you know, are there ways, keeping in mind the uncertainty of can we actually get together in person sort of thing. But, you know, is there a way to, you know, support some summer learning programs and bridge programs over the summer to help get kids get caught up? And can that not just fall on the school system? They're in the metro area, but not so much in the rural areas. Mm-hmm. You know, can we utilize like summer programs? How do we align summer support programs really in line with what the school needs? Out in the rural area, 4-H could be a huge supplement mm-hmm. to what the schools are trying to do. And so it's going to take more than just telling school systems, you need to ramp up and ramp up quickly. It's going to take, you know, community investment, community organization support, private public dollars. Mm-hmm. But the trick is really figuring out what are those most needed critical things. And a lot of them are going to be around the emotional mental health of the families and the teachers. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially in areas like where Dr. Reagan Martin is, you're going to have a lot of post-traumatic stress, mm-hmm. a lot of mental health issues as these families are going through quite a bit of trauma, and the teachers too. Mm-hmm. And so all of that trauma is going to be coming back into the classroom, and that really affects learning, even if you had the perfect learning system, you know, laid out. And so what are those mental health resources that need to be in place? So it's really about the right resources targeted where they need to be, and especially outside of metro area where there aren't a lot of summer learning programs or supplemental programs that could be aligned with school system needs and goals. How do we prop those up?
Those wraparound services that we hear so much about here in the in the urban areas, and those non-academic barriers to student success. And and so, Superintendent Martin, when we also think about school to work pathways, because we have a lot of seniors, if there is another source of school to work pathway that they can access.
That is definitely an issue. And I will say that the schools, of course, have been instrumental in helping those students with that pathway from school to work. We have a work-based learning program. Dr. Shanice Richardson is our work-based learning coordinator and our CTAE director. And you know, she works closely with those students and trying to create that pathway for them. And with us not being in school, they just don't have that adult to help them figure out what the next steps are. And of course, with businesses being closed, that's just another barrier. They don't know what to do. So right now, they're just at home and waiting for some direction.
Yeah, you know, that's one of those things that there's so many unfortunate timings. They're never a good time for a global pandemic, obviously, but Georgia had been really making a lot of strides and doing really a sort of a national leader around these work-based learning pathways, our college and career tech programs, and they're really, really good in helping kids transition into post-secondary, either a technical school or into the work environment. But most of them are really based on hands-on learning, apprenticeship programs, partnerships with businesses, all of these sorts of things that require, you know, in-person contact. And so from a long-term planning perspective, what does it mean if over the next, you know, 18 months, our ability to come together will be, you know, probably interrupted. And so how do we keep, you know, thinking of just the workforce pipeline, which really affect economic growth, not just because the economy shut down right now, but over the next 2 to 3 years, these interruptions and training our next set of workers, it's going to have some really long-term impacts. And so we need to quickly kind of figure out, how do we keep these things going in a virtual way? You know, can you train virtual welding?
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know. At some point, you probably need to do some actual welding. And so these are some questions that, you know, in the state level, we're really trying to figure out quickly to keep the solid programs that we have going.
As we wrap up, what comes out of this? What lessons will be learned? And so the question for you all as educators, what lessons will be learned coming out of this pandemic in terms of not only just how we educate, particularly K through 12, public education in this nation, but also for our educators? How do we move forward after all of this?
I will say that our community is very close-knit, and one of the benefits of a small community is that we all pitch in and help each other the best we can. That's one of the benefits that has come out of this, that we all reach out, and you know, if somebody needs meals, we try to provide meals. If somebody needs groceries, we go buy groceries. But it has definitely given us a clear idea that there is a wide gap between some of our haves and our have-nots, that there are a lot of kids who don't have, you know, whether it's just connectivity, that is a huge thing. Mm-hmm. And maybe we didn't think it was so huge before, but now all of a sudden there is that glaring view on the disparity between what kids have access to and what other kids don't.
Dr. Rickman.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, you know, the crisis has certainly highlighted the problems that us in the education community have been talking about for a long time, especially this access, this equity access, and this access to opportunity. But I think it's put a really glaring spotlight on how detrimental it is and how it really needs to be addressed for the good of the whole state. I think one of the good things that have come out of this is that for people who are not in education, they have a much better understanding of the role the public education system plays in the daily lives of their community, not just educating the children, which obviously is their primary role, mm-hmm. but that the K-12 system in particular, and the early care system in particular, has really over the years taken on the roles of community collaborator, and they look after the health and wellness of the families and the students. And to the extent that the education system does so much more than just education, I think this is becoming much more obvious to people who are not in it every day. Mm-hmm. And so I think that appreciation, if we can learn anything, is how to keep that going and support the education system so they can keep doing the job that they've always done.
Dr. Dana Rickman, Vice President of the Georgia Partnership for Excellence in Education. Also, Dr. Broen Reagan Martin, Superintendent of the Early County Board of Education in Southwest Georgia. And we've been talking about rural school districts. Thank you both for taking the time of a very important and critical conversation right now. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
That's it for this edition of Closer Look, which is produced by Grace Walker and LaShawn Hudson. Our engineer is Shelley Canavy. If you missed any of today's program, it's online at wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, you can listen to Closer Look weeknights at 8 p.m. and listen whenever you want, because Closer Look is now available as a podcast. Just visit NPR One or your favorite streaming app and subscribe. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.